hour into the next episode. Okay. Knowledge sharing. Why are these big institutions and why is there such a fear about knowledge sharing within COVID? I mean, if it's a global pandemic, obviously what you want to do is kind of what the body does, right? It's what militaries do. You band together, you team together, everyone brings in their strengths, and you beat this thing. That is not the case here. It's let's all worship, you know, our Lord and Savior, Dr. Fauci, and ignore everyone else. So what in your experience, like, I mean, I don't even want to like mention his name again in this episode personally. You can talk about him if you want, but like just with the fear of like not getting all my platforms shut down, because that's one of the things they're doing to quell, you know, the spread of knowledge and information is shutting people down for using like a few buzzwords in the wrong order. Where is this kind of apprehension and ceasefire when it comes to knowledge sharing? Like, why is that the case? Is it just because of ego within the medical community? Dr. Ram Yugendra.
Money.
Money?
Comes down to money.
Oh, patents. That's disgusting. Money.
Who controls what? So one of the reasons I think that many groups don't want to work with us is because InsultDX is their private company. We're on the dark side. And you know, one of the things we get leveled as criticism is like, oh, these guys are in it for the money. Well, our team is anesthesiologists, emergency room doctors. You know, we're all in our clinical practice. Like, we don't need to be doing this. I mean, whatever we get from doing this project is nothing from our clinical work, which is, you know, mm-hmm. so we sort of scoff at that. It really was about addressing it because all of us were seeing this in the hospital in our practices. And we wanted to address it. And also many of us were seeing this with our personal friends, with our friends and family. So, you know, and then the criticism InsultDX gets is like, well, they're for profit, they're a private organization. I'm going, well, yeah, but what do you think about those academic institutions who are signing all those contracts, all these NDAs? Yeah. So if you work at an academic institution, any work that you do is owned by the university. All your publications are owned by the university. All your patents are owned by the university. All the IP of any work that you do is owned by the university, and they monetize it. And that's fine. That's the nature of the business. But that's why there's very little collaboration between a lot of the academic centers, because they're always trying to like outdo one another. Plus, there's an arrogance in the medical community because they all want to like publish papers. They all want to become the associate professor and then the, I don't know, top professor. It's all about the number of papers that you publish. And yeah. I had an opportunity to be in academia when I finished my training. And I just mm-hmm. thought it was awful because you just have, you know, you're just on the lower end of this totem pole, just doing scut work and grunt work so you can get your name on a paper. So maybe 20 years from now, I might be an associate professor who's just got a janitor closet converted into an office space that I maybe spend an hour per week on pretending I'm writing a paper. I just didn't really, you know, didn't really inspire or excite me. I went into medicine because, you know, I have an art background and it was being an artist and it's about trying to push the limits and understand things and having the freedom and having that, you know, that American ingenuity. The way mm-hmm. my family moved to America is to explore. I just personally found being in a restrictive academic institution or an establishment hospital, there's a huge hierarchy that would not allow me to think outside the box and to push limits and to see and do it within the confines of, you know, safe clinical practice and the guidelines. You can still do it, which is what we're doing. But again, Bruce and I don't answer to anyone. We come up with an idea. We're like, let's research that. Let's look at that. And, you know, we can talk a little bit about the vaccines and our vaccine paper that's going to come out in a couple of weeks. And we can dive into that because the interesting thing about the vaccine is it's, you know, the same pathology and the etiology as long haulers. So I always say the vaccine, people are having persistent symptoms after the vaccine are the cousins of long haulers. So we can talk about that in a second. But going back to your yeah. question, Kay, about the academic centers, it's what it is. It's competition. They just don't want to collaborate. Bruce and I have talked to many big institutions, like I said, the letter organizations. It's like, oh, great job, thanks a lot, guys, but we don't want to, you know, we don't ever want to hear from you ever again, sort of attitude. But the good thing is there's one academic center. I'm not going to say the name right now because we're going to make a big press release on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. They're a big hospital medical school system that they have agreed to run our randomized control trial. So really, really excited about that. It was like the doctor, the chair of the hospital, the chairman of medicine, and one of our patients was a radiologist at the hospital and who had long haul COVID. Bruce and I worked on her for about 6 to 7 weeks and got her better. Like where I think she's like 99% or close to 100% better. And she went to her chair of medicine and said, okay, these guys are legit. Like I went to all these places. I'm a doctor. These guys are doing the work. This is it. Yeah. So the chair of medicine looked at what we were doing, started using the kits, started using some of the medications we were recommending and what we were using. He was sold. I mean, so he goes, okay, I'm in. What do we do? I was like, I need you to run this trial. Be the PI, mm-hmm. bring your resources from the medical school, your institution. We can design a trial because we've seen over 2,000 patients. We understand the pathology. We understand what we need to be studying. Because that's the other problem right now. All the others, they don't know what they're studying. Like they don't understand the pathology. So if you don't understand the pathology, you don't know what you're studying. How can you run a damn trial? So we put this together. We are hoping that at the beginning of 2022, we're going to start enrolling patients and seeing. So basically what we're seeing clinically is we're going to put this in a trial and try to prove it that in a statistical significance and a clinical trial design and say like these medications are working because this is the pathology that we found. So
is the trial, and this is just like purely for my own nerdiness, because I don't talk about this, but I did the same kind of thing as you. Like I was offered to stay on at my university after my undergrad in the UK, which by the way, undergrads in the UK for like non-specialized topics, like the thesis that we write is as complicated as the PhDs that I write for people out here in the same field. But it's the same thing, you know, like everything's owned by the university and like it's all socialist-y nasty. And so that's why I came out to the States, right? It's for that degree of freedom that you can do. But the nerd in me still lives on strong. So I'm assuming it's going to be, as a clinical trial, predominantly quantitative. How do you, are you going to talk about the kind of symptomology in terms of, but you know what I mean? Of the say like brain fog, fatigue, aspects like that. Is there going to be a clinical aspect to the trial or is it going to be exclusively quantitative?
No, it's both because we want the subjective and we want the objective data because we, you know, it's important. It's a lot of this is, you know, we're talking about human beings here. We're not talking about test subjects and it's very important. So, you know, the subjective, we use subjective information from the patients when they feel better. We want to know what does feel better look like using biomarkers, using, you know, sort of concrete data. And when we see, when we use biomarkers to guide in our approach, we want to then hear how is this, how does the patient feel symptoms wise and what their, the clinical presentation is. They go hand in hand. Yeah. The problem is that, you know, when you're talking about like fibromyalgia, ME/CFS, whatnot, we've only been relying so much on subjective data and subjective responses because what are the biomarkers that we're going to be using? There's, you know, really unknown. And again, we feel like we've got some very strong biomarkers. One, those inflammatory markers. Two, what the hell is causing this? Those S1 proteins in those monocytes. And what we're seeing is as we clear those monocytes down or clear the proteins, the COVID particles, patients get better. So once we get them down to zero, most of them are feeling like, you know, they're like 70% better. So we're seeing that the sort of correlation between decreasing inflammatory markers, decreasing the COVID proteins, the S1 protein, mm-hmm. and symptoms wise decreasing. And that's the most important thing at the end of the day is getting people feeling better. So the trial is.
Oh, sorry. I have so many questions, but carry on.
The trial is going to be an open label where we're going to be enrolling patients into this trial. We're going to be studying maraviroc and atorvastatin. Maraviroc is a CCR5 antagonist. It was developed by Pfizer to study HIV in 2007. Mm-hmm. And we're also using atorvastatin, which was developed by Pfizer to treat cholesterol. And there's a reason why we're using Pfizer drugs. I'll let you put that piece of the puzzle together.
I do still have a couple more questions though about the actual trial, just because, you know, I do miss working with my academic clients. You know, if there's anyone out there listening who needs help with their PhD, please get in touch, because it gets my blood going. I love, if you'll pardon, I guess, a pun in this kind of context. But I mean, in terms of the kind of qualitative aspects, that's my preference. Like, I've always been a qualitative researcher, but I prefer that kind of mixed methods approach. And for those listening, I don't want you to like sort of, you know, all the non-academics who are listening, please don't fall asleep right now as we start getting really sciencey. I guess the way that I describe the difference between qualitative and quantitative is you want to find out exactly how someone feels, and you kind of use that. I prefer an open-ended interview approach. I find that other times of like Likert scales and survey data, I just find it's limiting personally, I think. Obviously, open-ended interviews can take a lot longer. It's a lot more work, but there are some amazing softwares out there that you can use to code that data pretty swiftly. I have a preference for InVivo. Again, they should sponsor me because of how much I work with that freaking software. But I think being able to kind of validate that with the quantitative, the numerical data that you guys are going to be collecting, I mean, the study could be revolutionary. And I think it's more than, you know, any other institution or individual is doing right now. And it kind of shocks me and saddens me to think that it's so human driven. And I haven't seen a lot of that in what is being pushed through the media from these other larger institutions. It seems to be all about, dare I say it, control. So I think I'm genuinely excited to see your results. Like, I want to get like regular updates on how the trial is going. I don't know what the legalities of that would be, whether we have to talk online or offline, but really excited, really fascinated, would love to help write up anything that you guys have. But can I ask about the Pfizer stuff, or should we just let other people put that together?
We'll let other people put that together, because those are some ongoing discussions. But I think it's interesting because they are Maravarac, also known as Selzentry, was developed, I said, approved by the FDA in 2007, also approved in the UK by the MHRA and the European the EMA to treat HIV. So that's a major drug that we've been looking at. The reason we found the benefit of using Maravarac is that garbage truck, or that immune cell, expresses a receptor called CCR5, which if you block it, you pull it away from sites of inflammation. It's something called an immunomodulator. So what is taking place in long COVID, and now in these patients with the vaccine symptoms, is that there's an immune dysfunction taking place. And one way of looking at it is like, you imagine a chessboard with all the pieces are just, they're not where they're supposed to be. And what a drug like Maravarac does is reset the chessboard. So it's not an antiviral, it's not an anti-inflammatory, it's an immunomodulator. And that's the secondary effects of the medication. Because the question is like, why are you giving an HIV medication? Again, in HIV, it acts as an antiviral because CCR5 is a co-receptor, where when the HIV, the virus, binds to the T cell, it uses GP120, which is a glycoprotein on the virus, and it binds to the CD4 receptor on the T cell. But what researchers found like over the last 20, 30 years, so there's a co-receptor called CCR5. And by blocking that receptor, you can prevent that HIV from latching onto that, that immune cell and infecting it. So that's why the drug and that class of drugs called CCR5 antagonists has been studied, continues to be studied by many other companies. They're trying to develop their own, but Pfizer has the only one that's approved in the world. And what we found is that it also has, obviously with that HIV piece, but it also has an effect on mitigating the inflammatory response. So let's put it this way. okay, if you were in a fight on First and Main Street and with someone that wanted to mess you up, well, what you do is you send a text message to Dr. Drew, you send a text message to your best friend, you send a text message to your neighbor and say, look, I'm about to get my ass kicked. Can you guys come over to First and Main Street and help me out? And can you guys bring your own like weapon? So Drew, being the badass that he is, he brings a little pocket knife. Your best friend brings a machete, and your neighbor brings like an AK-47. Okay, they come to the fight. Now, this one little fight between you and this other person has suddenly gotten bigger, and mm-hmm. each of those people have their own weapons. Well, what Maravarak does is that it's like putting a blocker on the text messages that you sent to Drew, your best friend, and neighbor. So now they're not coming to the fight because they never got the signal. They never got the text message. And they're not bringing their individual weapons to the fight. So that fight is still staying small. And that's what happens in inflammation. And that's what happens in long COVID, especially inflammation. And what we're doing is we're blocking the signal. So the other immune cells don't come in and worsen the inflammation.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And the other mechanism it does is it pulls those immune cells away. It just like, it's like a magnet that pulls them away. The other mechanism that we're doing is, remember I said those immune cells or the garbage trucks, they stick to blood vessels like Velcro. And what statins do, it's like putting a piece of paper between Velcro. What happens? It doesn't stick. So now it doesn't stick. You're pulling them away. And then you're over time, you're then causing them to undergo something called apoptosis or programmed cell death. We know that because what's happening is in these patients is they have high levels of the garbage trucks, higher than normal, with the COVID particles in it. And as the patients get better, the garbage trucks, the numbers of them start to normalize. The COVID proteins start to go away. The inflammatory markers start to go away. And that's what the clinical trial is actually going to show. Is going back to the design of it, it's an open label design. Open label meaning if you had a positive COVID test, we enrolled you, you will get Maravarak and atorvastatin. After 4 weeks, everyone that says that they improve the subjective response or their symptoms, they say, my brain fog got better, my fatigue got better, my POTS got better, my XYZ got better. All of them are going to go into phase two of the trial. The ones that do not improve on those medications, they drop out, and we'll probably study them with different medications. So now if this is an enriched sample size, they are now going to be randomized. So the second phase of it is, no, these are ones that got the medications, they improved. One arm is going to get the placebo and the other arm is going to continue on medications. And they're going to go on medications for another 8 weeks. The trial will be a total of 12 weeks. So it's going to be assumed if these medications are working, that one, the group that now is getting the placebo, is their symptoms are going to come back again. The ones that are continuing to get medications, they're going to continue improving. And that's the hypothesis. If our approach is going to be, if it does work and has some statistical significance to it, it's going to, those patients are, their biomarkers are going to continue going down. Whereas the ones in the placebo group, we should assume it'll plateau or in some instances start to go up again. So that's sort of the design of it. Why 12 weeks? Because what we've seen clinically, again, in over 2,000 patients, they need a minimum of 8 weeks. Like no one really gets completely better or that 80, 90% better in 4 weeks. It's about 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And so we don't want to have the trial going on too long because then they're going to recover. And it's, so so that's the framework of the 3 months that we put together for studying this group of patients.
So how does, in terms of both enrollment and relationship to the study, how does vaccinated versus unvaccinated work? Are you going to be working with people who've received the vaccine or people who haven't received the vaccine? Is that, what's the word I'm looking for? I have brain fog today, but it's a Sunday and I fell asleep very early and I slept too long. But is that going to be a factor? That's what I was looking for. In your study, like as part of it, or are you going to, like, how is that playing into the study?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think our inclusion criteria is going to be that had a positive COVID test, because, you know, unfortunately you have a a group of patients from January of 2020, or maybe even December of 2019 to July of 2020 that didn't have access to proper testing. And, or they had tested, but it was just really, you know, terrible testing methods, and you know, the PCR is such a crap test that, so it's really hard to say if they had COVID or not. And from a study perspective, we need to have, you know, we really need to make sure we had someone that did have a positive COVID test. So that's one inclusion criteria. In terms of the vaccine, I think we would include both the vaccinated and the unvaccinated groups, only because in sort of enrolling patients and considering close to 59% of now people have gotten vaccinated, it would be interesting to sort of see the two groups. So right now we're going to most likely include both groups. We haven't really made a final decision on that piece, but I'm going to say yes, we'll probably include both groups in that. It's a little bit of a tough situation because one is we know that the vaccine on long haulers, it's not, you know, a few months ago you saw the major media put out all these things that the vaccine is therapeutic, might quote unquote cure long COVID. And Bruce Patterson and I and our team literally just did what you did, roll our eyes and said, this is one of the most disingenuous, unethical reporting that has been done. One of the things, especially COVID related, because we were not seeing that. We were seeing about 10% of patients of long haulers would get the vaccine and they would get better. And the interesting thing too, is about a month later, they would go back to baseline. They go back to the baseline symptoms. But they were not being followed by those reporters because they did a snapshot. You got the vaccine last week. You feel better. Oh my God, there it is. The vaccine is the solution for it.
Yeah.
What we were seeing is that about 50% of the patients, it didn't do anything. It didn't help them. Didn't make them better. Didn't make them worse, which is good because now you got the antibodies. Maybe they protect mm-hmm. them from COVID. 30% got significantly worse. Ooh. And here's the thing. The critics to come and say, well, how do you know they got worse? Because we sent the blood work in right after and we tested it like a month later. And some of these patients were 80, 90% better. Like Bruce and I got them almost recovered from their long COVID, reset their immune system, went and got the vaccine. They are now debilitated. They're in bed now. And we tested their blood work, inflammatory markers off the roof. Oh, I mean, if you look at our report, it'll come in red and it'll say, hi. One of our patients, I just clearly remember, she called me. She was about to go to the emergency room. She had just gotten the vaccine. She goes, I'm probably the worst. I'm worse off now than I did while I had COVID. Oh. And she's been like that. She's now been 4 months since the vaccine and she's debilitated. She had ended up having pericarditis. We had to call all these specialists. She's been on all these medications. It's really frustrating because we had her close to 80, 90% better. And, you know, we don't ever want to tell people to not take the vaccine or take the vaccine. You know, we're not an anti-vax group, but we tell them, look, let's get you better first and then consider the vaccine. Unfortunately, the media put out this report that the vaccine is going to be the solution. And a lot of people went out and got it, got messed up. That made its way through the message boards. That fuels the anti-vax movement because now people are going, aha, see those journalists, see that media? They said the vaccine is going to be the cure for it, but it set you back. And now people are going, maybe these anti-vax people are right. Maybe these vax skeptics are right. You see, it's like these people don't realize like they're feeding the narrative. Mm-hmm. They continue feeding that narrative. And then they sit there going, well, I don't understand why all of these people are skeptical about the vaccine because you're doing it. You're not being honest with people. So with that being said, a lot of those patients are vaccinated. You know, like I said, 50%, thankfully, didn't get worse off from the vaccine. They made antibodies. And so we can't necessarily exclude them from the trial. But it is something to take into consideration for future studies, because maybe we might want to do a study on unvaxxed versus vaccinated. There's so many different things that we could study. You know, we are looking at both maraviroc and atorvastatin. I think it'll be interesting to see how individually each of those drugs work in a trial setting. I can tell you right now, from a clinical standpoint, we don't really see that much benefit just putting a patient just on a statin or maraviroc. It's the combination because it's working on two different pathways. But again, that's a future trial that could be done to study individually what specifically are each of those medications doing. The good thing is we're not trying to get an approval for a new experimental medication. These are already approved. They are approved and in market. It's just, we're just trying to find an indication, because a lot of skeptical doctors and doctors don't want to participate and say, well, where's the data on this? And look, I understand. So we have to go through the motions and we do have to prove this in a trial setting. So that's pretty much what the our goal is of the trial, is to show some, you know, hopefully some statistical, you know, the p-values that everyone loves. And if it's not a randomized controlled trial, then it's like, oh, ooh, I don't know about this. And, you know, again, we're probably going to get some criticism, because the trial design is actually Dr. Osgood, one of other doctors on a team. He's got a very strong clinical trial background, and his expertise has been huge in sort of designing the trial. And Eric, you know, we were going back and forth, because this is a chronic pain approach. So of course, academics are going to say, well, why are you studying a chronic pain? No, because long haul, our approach is really a lot of, it mimics chronic pain research. And we just thought this trial is going to be great, because one is, we're going to have an enriched population. See, the key, what Dr. Patterson and I have talked about, is precision medicine. We hear that cliche, everyone is unique. Everyone is different. Everyone has different biomarkers. Your genetic code is different. But here's the thing. We use the same medications for the same people over and over and over and over again. It's like we know this, but medicine hasn't evolved. We still do medicine the same way we did 40 years ago. How do I know? My dad's a clinician. My dad's a physician. He's a pulmonary critical care doc, board certified, quadruple board certified, in three different countries in three different continents, right? And so yeah. I studied, you know, he's old school brown man, that he brings his textbooks from the UK and from Sri Lanka. I'd be like, all right, read this. So I remember in medical school and residency reading these old things, and I'm going, oh my God, we have not evolved. We're still doing the same things my dad did when he was training in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And the same approach. And so what Bruce and I have taken is a precision medicine, is saying, look, Maraviroc and atorvastatin is not going to be the solution for every long hauler. It's not. I'll tell you this right now. I'm very open about this with patients, with doctors. When we talk presentation, 20% of patients are not responding to these medications. It could be a multitude of reasons. One is they may not have had COVID in the first place. They might have got acutely damaged from COVID, and they're not dealing with the pathology we've discovered. And three, there might be something else going on that we haven't discovered that we don't know. So, but I'm very confident that the other 70, 80% of patients are going to respond to these medications. So part of it is saying it is not going to have 100% success rate. Like not everyone's going to, you know, respond to it. And it goes back to how we manage patients with COVID. Because if you look at these clinical trials that have been done, the reason why nothing has been approved yet is because we take this like mentality from the 1950s medicine, where one size fits all, even though we all inherently know that everyone is uniquely different. So why don't the trials reflect that? Why don't you use, for example, Maraviroc, for example, targets CCR5 receptors. We know that has elevations in RANTES, VEGF, IL-6, IL-8. What are those? Those are the specific inflammatory markers that it targets. So why not, I don't want to use the word cherry pick, but sort of use that as an inclusion criteria into your trials, because you know the mechanism of how the drug works. So if you study that on patients with certain biomarkers, then you're going to get the statistical significance. And sure, people are going to say, well, then you have to measure this for people before they can get the drug. Yes, that's exactly what we do. Not everyone in our program gets Maraviroc and atorvastatin. You got to have XYZ markers, and then we give you the medications and you're going to respond to it. So that's how the trial should be designed. That's all what Bruce and I are talking about. When you're studying acute COVID, you got to know what you're studying. Like all these, there's so many experimental drugs. They've not been able to, for many reasons, many of them, obviously the politics of small biotech companies, the resources, how much everything is heavily skewed towards big pharma in these hospitals and these trials, that these small biotech companies want to, you know, they're only studying 300 patients while Pfizer's got like, you know, 5,000 patients because the hospital, the doctors, they're all sending the patients to that trial, not to the little biotech company. So one, they have small numbers, so their power on their study is going to be low. The second thing is that they're poorly designed trials. And I talked to some of these little biotech companies. I'm like, you know the mechanism of your drug. Why don't you give the drug to people you know are going to respond to it and study that? Don't just give it to everyone. Well, we want to treat it because there's a big market for it. It's this mentality of like, well, that's the reason why your drug's not going to be approved, because you're going to give it to people that are not going to respond to the drug. See, for example, if you have COVID and you go to the ICU, they're not going to measure any of these inflammatory markers. They just don't have the capability of it. They're going to say, okay, you're going to get steroids, you're going to get remdesivir, you're going to get, I don't know, a ventilator. And I mean, hopefully the God you pray to is going to be merciful. I mean, literally, that's what it boils down to. What we should be doing is the moment you get into the hospital or the ICU, we measure inflammatory markers. We see specifically what is elevated because it varies from patient to patient, how your immune response, how your physiology is going to be. And you give medications that target it specifically to those markers that's causing the damage. A one size fits all is not going to work. And when you're doing a clinical trial, you should be doing that too.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. God, I'm just envisioning all of this. And okay, so sorry, I've got a cat on my lap, so I keep getting cat hairs stuck up my nose. For people watching, I hope I haven't been picking my nose. But in terms of the kind of one size fits all approach, we've talked offline about, again, sort of like going back to the vaccine. And again, I'm not anti-vax, like my family's all vaccinated. I moved to America for personal freedoms. You do what you want to do so long as it doesn't hurt other people. All right. Like that's how I choose to live. But as far as like how it comes to the vaccine, you know, you described earlier the kind of three sort of differences, you know, the people who get the vaccine and they recover in the short term, symptoms come back, the people who get it and it doesn't really like seem to do anything, I'm assuming, like, is that's like the other control. And then there's the group who get it and things get way worse. So in terms of, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the people who get the vaccine who have long haul COVID and they get worse, that seems to be the largest group, unfortunately. And again, Google, freaking YouTube, Twitter, please don't cancel me for this. Like, we're literally just talking about data here. And I doubt half the people who work for these companies who set the censorship even bother to understand like what we're even talking about. But especially as it comes to, you know, statistical data. But what is it that you're seeing that creates things? It's the spike protein, right?
And
I would love to just dig into that a little bit, because again, I see sort of my job, like I'm pretty lucky. I work for like a handful of major national outlets. And I'm just a writer, you know, that's all I really do. Like I write this show, I do this for fun. I have like a handful of copywriting clients. Like I don't make any money from this podcast. I purely do it because I would have these conversations anyway. And I feel incredibly lucky that I get to have these conversations and share them with other people, right? Like I'm a professional freaking nerd. I love talking to people about what they do. And I'm saying all of this in the hopes that it doesn't get us both canceled, because who knows what's going to get you canceled in this day and age. I think there is a complete mitigation from all major news outlets. I've seen one or two reports, maybe if that, on Fox. I've seen nothing on The Blaze, Daily Caller. Like none of these outlets are really even willing to touch upon the negative side effects of this vaccine. But I'm sitting here with, you know, a leading expert on this and I want to dig into it. So like, what does that look like? What are your sort of opinions and takes on it, and what should people be aware of, I guess, would be the sort of three questions.
Yeah. So I think off the bat, like anyone that's sort of researching the vaccine, we're not anti-vax. I'm fully, you know, I'm vaccinated. Yeah. My parents actually got the booster. I told them, you know, mom and dad, get the booster. You know, your risk factor, your age, their risk factors, definitely get the booster. You know, I read the data, I look at this. when you look at the denominator, you're talking about 400 million doses that's been administered in the United States. So you're talking about a very large denominator. The numerator is, I don't know. If I had to guess, I don't think it's going to be that big compared to the denominator, but I do think it's significant enough that we need to just study it and we need to explore it. When we don't study and we don't explore anything in science and medicine, it fuels skepticism. It fuels these anti-vax movements, and that's harmful. Yes. That I think is doing a real disservice, because when it appears that you're hiding something by just being ignorant about it, that's when the sort of these skeptics, these loudmouth skeptics go, aha, I told you, this is what they're hiding. They're hiding something. I think also it's very important to distinguish between hypothesis and theory and what the evidence shows. Like, I could hypothesize that, okay, you get the vaccine and you're going to have, and, you know, an alien is going to abduct you because you're going to be sending signals, right? And the question then is like, prove it. Well, I hypothesize that this is what's going to take place. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, the whole 5G thing, which is hilarious. I got a chuckle out of that. It's like 5G is something about the vaccine is controlled by 5. Oh, something, maybe the virus, yeah. Something about
and
that.
And then 5G is controlled by the Chinese, and then
something like that, right?
There are lizard people, and the weather is a weapon. Yeah, no,
exactly. So, okay, where's the evidence of that, right? So that's a hypothesis, and that's a theory. So I think we'd be very careful, because some of these people that are skeptical about the vaccine or talking about it, they're talking in hypothesis. What they're doing is they're also looking at epidemiological trends and making inferences about it, being, oh, look at this. These people got the vaccine on this day, this group of patients, and then COVID broke out like a week later. Well, no, there's so many other confounders and things that need to be, you know, that you need to control for and look for and other factors. So you can't use epidemiological data trends to make any clinical or inferences unless you have some data. Show us some blood work. Show us the proof. Show us a publication. Otherwise, run a disclaimer and say, this is my theory. It could happen. So I think we have to be very careful when we talk about that, because we do have people, you know, they misconstrue the hypothesis and theory as true. Aha, Dr. So-and-so, who's got all these credentials, is saying this. Well, Dr. So-and-so might be right, but Dr. So-and-so hasn't shown the data. We can show the data. We can show the blood work. What we're seeing in some of these patients with the post-vax issues is they're mimicking symptoms like long-haul COVID. And some of them did have COVID before. And some of them say that they didn't have COVID. They have a couple of different tests that are suggestive of it. It's not 100%. They might have had COVID before. Regardless, they get the vaccine. 2-3 weeks later, they're still continuing to have symptoms. 6 months later, they're having symptoms. 9 months later, they're having symptoms. And these symptoms are brain fog, fatigue, POTS, tinnitus, more neurological, peripheral neuropathy.
Yeah.
Seizures. They're having uncontrollable, like some of them have these tics and myalgias, and they're debilitated, can't go to work. They're lying home at bed now, being like, and so they go to the doctors and they say, look, I had this, you know, having these problems after the vaccine. And the doctors, rightfully so, say, like, well, you know what? It may most likely is not due to the vaccine, because, you know, CNN and CBS and NBC and Rolling Stone said the vaccine is safe and effective. So they said, we're going to run a gauntlet of tests, and we're going to see what's going on with you. So these patients get a gauntlet of tests. Everything comes back negative, and they're told, this is all in your head, and go away. Just like exactly like long haulers experienced over a year ago and continue to experience. So Bruce and I, we said, okay, well, let's study these patients. You know, we're studying not just COVID, we're studying chronic Lyme, we're studying ME/CFS and whatnot. And, you know, we looked at how the vaccine is being made. You know, when you have the mRNA that is injected, your then body, they're taken up by your cells and they make the S1 protein. Why is the S1 protein? Because that's the one that infects your cells. Remember, we talked about this on part one of our podcast. That's what infects it. So they isolated that S1 and they made antibodies to it. So it neutralized. So if you get infected, then those antibodies to the S1 are going to bind to it so that a virus cannot infect the cell. It's like putting a shield over it. So it can't. Yeah, exactly. Another way of looking at it. Right. So that's really what's taking place here. And so that's why the vaccine codes for S1, the S1 protein makes antibodies towards that. What we've been told is that for these mRNA and the DNA platform vaccines is that when they code for the S1, you make the antibodies, your body then destroys the S1 protein within a couple of days. You don't have any proteins in your immune, in your immune cells in your body.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we've been told. All the tests that the patients get, their doctors run, everything is negative, except when they do our panel. We find inflammatory markers that they all register on our long haul index.
Mm-hmm.
And then The other thing too is we actually looked at some of their immune cells and almost all of them have S1 proteins in them. Yep. This is our third paper. And I think Bruce and I, the plan is to drop this sometime next month. We were planning on submitting the paper about beginning of September. But we know that when we put this paper out, we're going to be torn to shreds. I make a joke that we are probably, you're never going to hear from Bruce Patterson and me ever again. We're going to be sent to some CIA black ops site in the middle of the Pacific.
Yeah.
For ourselves. And
this is when I need you to say the words, one, I will never commit suicide. Like, you need to say that stuff. Like, I have to say it. Like, I've done a couple of shows where I've been like, listen, I need you all to know that, like, I would never commit suicide, because that's the kind of thing, you know, like, they've killed Rolling Stone reporters, allegedly, you know, for shading on the military. I mean, this kind of stuff is going to be like, the Clintons are coming for you, mate.
I feel like, I'm in the middle of Woody Allen's The Front. I don't know if you ever saw that, but you know, it's about the whole blacklisting with McCarthyism.
Oh,
and it's like, the moment you just speak up, you're going to be blacklisted. You know, I know Bruce and I, we're going to be called disinformation or misinformation, even though we're going to have a paper out there that's going to show
raw data that proves
we're going to have raw data. Yeah. Right. And so here's the delay in the paper is that when we looked at the immune cells, we looked at using flow cytometry, which is a technique in laboratory medicine. And we found the S1 proteins. We wanted to confirm that it was the S1 protein. So we sent it to QSI. QSI got back to us about 2 weeks ago. And they confirmed using single molecule peptide sequencing that it was indeed the S1. So now we are 100% confident that it's the S1, just like our second paper.
Yeah.
The question is the S1 from the vaccine or from the virus? We found a couple of signals, a couple of amino acid sequences that are different from the virus. And the QSI team, the proteomics team, said, can you give us a little bit of time? We want to do a deep dive into this. So that's the delay. So the paper's all done. Bruce has written it. I've gotten the whole clinical piece together. We're waiting for QSI to come back and let us know what exactly they found in a deep dive. It is 100% the S1 subunit in these patients. We're trying to figure out if it's from the 100% versus from the vaccine versus, well, not 100%, but it's strong. We can strongly conclude that this is truly from the vaccine and not from the virus. If I were a betting person, I would say it's from the vaccine.
And so, you've just killed me too. Thanks, mate.
Sure, no problem. But again, we don't see this in a, we're not talking about millions of people. We're talking about a very small group of patients that this is taking place. That doesn't necessarily mean it's an anti-vax or anything. It's like, look, there's a small group of patients that are experiencing this. Let's treat it. We can continue vaccinating people. We can continue doing, doing what we're doing. But again, it's about being open and honest with people and being like, look, there's a small risk of this could happen, but there are some medications. There's some, things that can help. The very exciting thing is the same approach that Dr. Patterson and I are taking with long COVID is working for the post-vax patients. So we're getting them better in about 6 to 8 weeks. Exactly. So that small group of patients that are having the symptoms, we're able to treat them and kind of get them better or on the road to recovery. So again, it's about having that conversation with people. It's not, we're not, I know there's some other groups out there and doctors whose names I'm not going to mention. They use our research, and that's so frustrating. Be like, the Patterson group is doing this and this is what they're finding. And we're going, no. We're not saying that this is for millions of people. We're saying it's just a small group of patients. I don't know the epidemiology. We're not, you know, there's sampling bias. You know, we get this question a lot. I posted this on Twitter the other day where I said, like, don't look to us for epidemiological data. Don't ask me what is the percentage of patients that are experiencing this. We don't know. We think it's really, really small. Because whatever percentages I'm seeing from our practice is a sampling bias. These patients are coming and they're seeing us. They're seeking us out. They're not representative of the population. So I can't say like, oh, we're seeing 10% of our patients. This, that doesn't mean 10% of people that got vaccinated are experiencing this. We just don't know. We think it's a really small number though.
But that's and I think like that's another issue with people not really understanding how research works in these upper echelons. You know, you can't make these sweeping generalizations in any research, really, unless you sample every single human being on the planet, or you sample, you know, like 6 billion of the 8 or 9 billion of us there are now. And I think that's, you know, something that the media does very well, is sort of make these sweeping generalizations without, again, understanding it, because it's written by producers and people who couldn't get on air themselves and things like that. And it's kind of a terrifying cycle that I think has led to, both the anti-vax movement and is just sort of further contributing. Oh, so many cat hairs on my nose. further contributing to sort of that like ideological division that we're experiencing right now in the US. And I think, you know, ideological divides is something that this nation was founded upon. Like, we weren't all, like, none of us moved here to be the same as everyone else here. We moved here for that level of independence, and to not maybe lean into so much groupthink. And I see that that's what Ewan, I'm just going to call him Bruce, even though I never met him. I'm just going to call him Bruce. I think that's what you and Bruce are doing really well, is sort of taking that individualized approach and saying, A, the fact that you can admit that, you know, you don't know everything, that's a big deal. But most people don't want that. Most people don't, they want, you know, that's why they like that sort of, I'm not even going to call him the big man in charge, that little man who's in charge of this whole sort of PR mess around COVID. They want someone who's, you know, ballsy enough to stand up and say, I know everything and this is how things are going to be, even though he doesn't have the evidence to sort of make those sweeping generalizations. And I think it's actually long-term incredibly detrimental. And I do not think that history will necessarily favor him. I think history, I mean, I'm like stoked. I mean, if we survive all of this, mate, I am so excited for the HBO series, or maybe even Hulu. Hulu's coming out with some amazing shows. Like, we talked about Dope Sick in the last, in part one. I cannot wait until, I mean, I'm obviously going to write the book on your guys' research and how it came to be. And then we'll then sell that to HBO or Hulu to, you know, in like 20, 30 years. So it's like a reflective or whatever on this moment in our history. Because you really are those sort of rock and roll researchers who are putting patients first, patients before profits, and studying that data on that individualized level. I don't think I've ever read, I haven't read an academic study that I haven't at least enjoyed to a certain extent. I mean, I try to do at least like two or three a week. It used to be two or three an hour back when I was still working with academics, because you just sort of have to read that fast and digest that information and, you know, move beyond the abstracts and get into the real meat of it. But taking that individualized approach is incredibly difficult to do. It's incredibly complex. And so I guess going back to the trial that you're going to be starting, hopefully, you know, early 2022, you know, what you're looking at in terms of the two drugs that you're going to be studying across that kind of randomized trial, I mean, the potential results, there's going to be so much to extract from that that could go into other studies, I'm assuming, or are you just sort of focusing on, like, what is the kind of breadth of data that you're going to be collecting, or is that going to be, this fucking cat keeps jumping on my table and making everything wobble. What kind of data are you collecting that maybe falls outside of the kind of criteria that most people are going to look at, right? So when most people go and get this study, once it's done, you can download it or wherever you, you know, read your studies online. There's going to be a lot more data in there than just here's the two drugs that we used and here are the results. You know, you're doing a qualitative study. You're doing a study with a very broad range, I would say demographically, of participants. Is that data going to be available? Is that kind of, are you going to use that for sort of like follow-up studies? Like how, like, are you even thinking that long-term just yet? Cause my brain's already, I'm already like 5 years into the future of like.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, what we are going to study is, I think, the future of how we approach post-viral chronic illnesses. Because what we've learned from, what Bruce and I and our team have learned from COVID, the research we've done in long COVID and now with the vaccine, is an approach. We were able to study the vaccine in a matter of weeks because we had understood the approach with long COVID. What exactly are the steps to study the pathology? One of the things that, like, for example, talking about chronic Lyme, for example, we're still, you know, there's still a lot of unknown about chronic Lyme. There's still a lot of unknown about ME/CFS. What we're thinking is the role of proteins or proteomics is the future. And to study that, you need to have an approach. You need to have a scientific sort of like, what are the steps and what are we trying to find and what are we trying to get out of it? And then how we set up a clinical trial and put out papers and whatnot, instead of this mishmash of, it could be this hypothesis, let's throw some medicines on there. Our approach is, here is a proposed mechanism. Let's try to discover the mechanism and then start to understand therapies. With the vaccine, same thing. When we started seeing patients that had issues with the vax, we didn't understand mechanisms. So we were like, maybe giving a little bit of steroids or giving a little bit of aspirin and kind of being like, okay, until we understand the mechanism. When we found the S1 in the non-classical monocytes, it was boom. Now we've identified the mechanism to justify using the medications. So going back to the clinical trial, it's a pilot study. There will obviously have to be further clinical trials and bigger studies that we're actually trying to show that, you know, the signals that we're seeing clinically can be shown in a pilot study. There's definitely going to have to be, you know, more studies into these two particular drugs. Like I said, individually, how are they working in this group of patients? That's probably going to be a follow-up study. Obviously, use a larger cohort of patients, maybe even using different combinations of medications, because we are using those different things. And really to study that a little bit closely, like maybe there are more biomarkers that we can introduce and get even more precise in how we're treating these patients. Maybe they don't tolerate certain medications and we understand why and look for alternatives. And I think most importantly, it sets the groundwork for our research into using these therapies for other unknown viral or chronic illnesses out there. And that's the really exciting thing. Here's a really exciting thing. The approach that we're taking with long COVID and post-vax, it's working for chronic Lyme patients. Bruce saw this one guy, lives out in California right now, big, burly New York dude, got chronic Lyme for 15 years ago and has not been able to get out of bed. Like he was a swimmer, couldn't do anything. 5 days on Maraviroc and statin, he called Bruce Patterson and said, I went swimming for the first time in 15 years. And he started crying on a telemedicine consultation with Bruce. So it's anecdotal. But now we're hearing more and more and more. Now we hear 20, 30, 40, 50 patients going, that stuff that you guys put us on, it's better than any other antibiotic or any other thing these other doctors have been doing for the last 20 years for us. So now we're going, okay, why is this working? Let's use our approach that we learned from long COVID. Let's apply it to chronic Lyme. Let's apply it to chronic, you know, other Zika or whatever, you know, all sorts of other things out there. And let's really like sort of understand what it is. So absolutely, this is like, we're just laying the foundation. It does not end. This is why we are just so excited about the project and the program. It's the scientific approach that we have learned and are learning, more than the, you know, the whole cliche, it's the process, not the outcome. I think it's just really, it really applies here as we learn processes here to get the outcomes that we so desire.
That's incredible. Sorry, I'm absolutely speechless. I feel like, you know, I read my gut instinct pretty well, and I feel like I'm a very close, like I'm in the VIP section of spectators on something very special that's happening in our scientific development. And I think, you know, you and Bruce are, and your team, you know, that's miracle work, really. That's what it is. God.
You know what it is? You know, the other thing too is, as I mentioned earlier, you know, this started as a text message between Bruce and I at 2 a.m. And we didn't know what we were doing. We don't have a business plan. It was just more like, hey, let's just research this. Let's do this. Here's the thing. When Bruce and I, we only wanted to study about 10 patients, literally just put out a little tiny report. Yeah, 10 patients. That was it. Like, let's just see, because we're just curious and we're nerdy like that. Let's see what's going on. I went on Twitter and social media, and I would say, you know, some guy that says he's a physician and a researcher and an anesthesiologist, he's out there going, hey, we need your blood. We don't have a website. We don't have, you know, people are going like, who the hell are you? Who's Bruce Patterson? Like, who's InCelDX? Like, who are these guys? I said, we would like to study your blood. And can you send it to California? We will send you everything. There's no cost for you. The only thing you need to do is go get your blood drawn and send it back to us. And the response was like incredible. Like people all over the country and all over the world started to message us. And we actually had one guy who spent $1,000 and shipped his blood from the Netherlands to California overnight, $1,000. Because he's like, I want to know what is going on. And he was like, I think he was the third patient we ever tested. But here's the thing, Kay, it just tells you how broken our healthcare system is.
Yeah.
Many of those patients, their doctors were like, is this a scam? We don't want to draw your blood. They are nowhere to get the blood drawn. And I'm going, wait a second. There's no cost for patients. The InCelDX is sending the vials. They're sending the shipping. There's nothing. All you have to do is just get your blood drawn and send it back. That's it. But then doctors were like, I need a requisition form. Quest and LabCorp said, we don't draw blood work. You need to like, we only do things that people are paying for our services. People in the United States have a very difficult time getting their blood drawn.
Mm-hmm.
Simple blood draws. It's like pulling teeth. So you know what I used to do? I used to have people come to my house. Strangers, long haulers, sick people would come to my house on my kitchen table. I would draw their blood. I would then package it. I would get on FaceTime with Chris Mehta, who's the business person at InCelDX, because I could tell you a thing about shipping blood, put it in ice packs. I'm going to my refrigerator, get ice packs out, package it for these people, and drive up to FedEx and drop it off on them because they were so sick. Strangers. There was some guy on Twitter who calls himself Yo Dr. Yo. He says, come to my house. I'll draw your blood in my kitchen table. Nothing shady about that. Some people were so sick. I would actually, after I got done work in the hospital, I would go to their homes and I would draw their blood because they couldn't get out of bed. So, I mean, there's a real incredible story and a book to be written about all of this, because half the people on our study, the first paper, I know them. I drew their blood personally. Well, they came to my house. So that's why there's like this very strong affinity for these people towards Bruce and I, because they've met us. Like, we've drawn their blood. Like, we've gone into the weeds. We're right there with them. So seeing those patients also, like, it went from like being curious and wanting to research to more like, holy shit, there's a big public health crisis. Like, these are people I'm seeing. They're in my kitchen table. They're so desperate that they're going to drive to some guy's home and get their blood drawn. And they were like, you know what? You might have as well just murdered us and buried us. And we were so desperate, we were going to take that risk. So the other thing too that we do is we end up becoming the United States public health and healthcare for these patients, Bruce and I. Because what we do is not only do they get tested, they don't have doctors. They don't have anyone helping them. And what we do is we connect them with doctors all over the country. Like, I'll send them referral notes and say, we have this patient who got their lab work. Their doctors basically thinks this whole thing is a made up thing, despite the peer review papers and all of this data that we're putting out there, and the NIH and the CDC and the FDA and all this group saying, yes, this is a legit thing. There's still doctors that are like, nope, we don't want to believe this and we don't want anything to do with this. And we're waiting for the letter organizations to tell us what we can give. In the meantime, you're on your own. And what Bruce and I do is, for literally thousands of patients in the United States, we connect them with doctors. Like, it's us. They're getting their healthcare through us. Like, we're like, talk to this doctor over here. And I'll talk to the doctor and be like, can you please consider taking this patient in your practice? And these are doctors that are like-minded like us. They're saying, I want to address this. I will do whatever it takes. Tell me what to do.
Yeah.
And not only that, it's not in the United States and Canada, but now we're doing the same thing in Europe, in Spain, in Italy, in Germany, in England, in Wales, your hometown, Mexico, Colombia, Brazil. This is what we do. And as I'm saying, it's not even science anymore. It's like this movement to change healthcare and medicine. And I would be lying to you if I said this is what Bruce and I wanted to do. We had no idea. You know, we were getting gaslighted by so many doctors. Like, they would just basically tell Bruce and I to F off. I mean, Bruce has been studying, you know, he's been studying HIV and published like tons of papers since like the 1990s or 1980s. And, you know, we're both clinicians. We're both like, we're not selling you anything. I have no experimental medication to sell you on. I have no stocks to give you. I have nothing to give you. All I have to give you is just science and just some papers and to consider some repurposed medications. And we would get called, you guys are a scam. You guys are, I don't believe in this. Like, pretty much F off. And what we decided, what Bruce and I decided to do was, all right, if you're going to act that way, we're going to build our own network. And we built our own network. Just like basically two doctors that just built a network. Now we have 11 doctors that work in our team. We have three nurses. We are, like I said, a global company, a global group that is now addressing this all over the world. And
that's, well, God bless you crazy. Guys. And just going back to one of the points you made earlier, I had a friend who, and I would love for you to kind of like just expand on this a little bit. We're a little bit low on time, but I had a friend who, like us, immigrant, moved out here, did school, stayed on, did a lot of work. She's a therapist, got pregnant, her and her partner, and she decided to move back to, I don't want to say where she's from, because I think it'll be pretty easy to find her on my social media, and I like to keep my actual friends as safe as possible. But she moved back to Europe, shall we say. And after she gave birth, she wanted to come back to the States to visit all of us, you know, like bring the baby. I think Europeans are a lot more comfortable traveling with infants than most of the Americans that I've met. You know, it's just like, yeah, just put the baby in the seat and put it under the table. Like, it's fine. And she, obviously this was in the middle of COVID. And when she did the research, it was like, oh, you know, you're going to a high risk country. She's like, what do you mean? Like, it's, you know, the most developed country in the world. They were like, no, the healthcare in America is so poorly managed that it is considered a third world. And I know that that's like kind of an archaic term, even though when I was in university, we had a whole course called third world development or whatever. But it's really considered a third world country as far as actual medicine and healthcare goes, because it is high risk because of how poorly it's managed. And I think that's really what you've just described throughout these last 2 hours is not only the degree of the mismanagement, how it is so driven by ego, so driven by money and, you know, oh, I've got the IP on this, therefore I'm the best and now I've got all the money, blah, blah, blah. And I think a lot of people don't really realize that that's what drives a lot of people. Like, you know, I have a running joke that, you know, how do you tell if someone's been to Harvard? Wait 2 minutes in the conversation. But when it comes to sort of medical school, it's fairly similar, especially for like younger people, I think, you know, there's like such an ego that goes hand in hand with it. Whereas, you know, when you speak to people who really do the research and get down in the dirt, like particularly my friends back in the UK, like half of them who are doctors, the reason you can tell is because the shadows under their eyes. And they never really bring it up because they don't want to answer all the gross questions and what have you. They're far more like first responders in that regard. And I very much see that same motivation, that same degree of care that comes out of the work, not only that you do, because you're an incredibly grounded person, you know, like we've been like in contact now for a year or more. And I can't stand people. So if anyone's in my life for more than a year, then you're fucking stuck with me. Woo. But you know, to have that in terms of like your leadership from Bruce, this is obviously something that, you know, has followed him and his career. I want to ask you how you think this could play long term, because like I'm a trend forecaster, like that's what I do, but you're not, and I think that that's what makes you like such a great doctor. But in terms of how the research is evolving in these other countries, I guess like my last question today, you know, you're working all over Europe and, you know, you described like Latin America, and I'm trying to touch my face while being covered in cat hair and it's really annoying. So I'm sorry. But are you seeing the same kind of like egos come into play when it comes to your research, or is it far more driven from that perspective of we are in the middle of a global health crisis and we need to solve it by all means necessary, and, you know, fuck the egos, fuck the money, let's get people healthy?
Two things. The first thing you said about the American, I want to make the comment on what you said about the American healthcare system. So this is very British-y. The British, the GMC, the General Medical Council, which I'm registered with, so I can still practice medicine in the UK. So I do follow them now and then, some of the things they put out. I think they put out a white paper back in, I'd say like 2008, 2007, something like that, where they critiqued, which is what the British are really good at, is critiquing. They love to critique. So they critique the US, Canada, South African, Australian, New Zealand systems, healthcare systems, and they compared it to their great NHS. So it's just, it was funny. They found all these holes and flaws in the United States. And very interesting, when I went to get my registered to practice medicine in the UK, there were only two US training that they would, I don't want to say recognize, but they would sort of let you automatically get your license to practice in the UK. One was pediatrics and the other one was anesthesia, which was funny because my sister's a pediatrician and so and we were both born in the UK. So we both got our license, like we got our GMC to practice medicine in the UK, which was really exciting. We're like, oh, this is cool. We didn't have to take any more tests or whatever. It was sort of like recognized being board certified in the US. Mm-hmm. But everything else, every other specialty, the UK, the GMC was very skeptical. They're like, we're not necessarily sure. We need some more paperwork. So just going back to your point about, you know, your European friends and your UK friends really looking at very down upon the American system. I mean, that is very British and UK-like to be like, well... I would say this, the same thing that's happening here in the US, it's happening in Europe, but there are still really amazing doctors that are thinking outside the box, that are really pushing the limits. You know, there's one Austrian neurologist, Michael Stingel, that we've talked to, and I love the work that he's doing out in Austria, and he's really a big ME/CFS researcher, and you know, we have a Slack group with all these doctors from Europe too that we contact with. They do seem to face some of the challenges we do here in the US. The worst, I think, are the UK. The UK doctors have just been downright, I mean, unbelievable resistance. They just do not want to listen.
They, in general,
I would say European
doctors.
Yeah. I mean, some of them have just been so dismissive of the work that, you know, Bruce and everyone on the team have done. And then it's just turned out that they just probably look down upon Americans and American training. Mm-hmm. That's what I really think boils down to. But, you know, we are actually in, we just signed an agreement with a UK consultant who is now building a large medical practice to help the UK patients dealing with long COVID and post-vax. Yeah, we are, I think probably in the next like 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to start testing UK patients now.
Oh, wow.
So he's we're going to send everyone from the UK in because no one else has wanted to step up. It's like the UK patients have it worse because they have to get their medications from India and Eastern Europe. So yeah, they're getting all their medications because they kind of follow what Bruce and I are doing. And I'm going, well, from one perspective, I don't necessarily think it's a good idea to be getting medications because you don't know where you're sourcing this from. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you're really getting the medication, but then from a public health perspective, you're like, or from a humanitarian perspective, it's like, I would probably do the same thing if I were in your boat. So who am I to sell you, like, don't do that? I, you know, it puts us in a really tough situation. It's like, what kind of advice do you give these patients? But it just goes to show you how there's very little support in the UK, because the problem is that you've got a system there that is so, there's so much of oversight and regulation. It has really stripped UK doctors from thinking. And I remember I said American ingenuity, even though despite the problems in America and our healthcare disparity and all the issues that were taking place, American ingenuity, we still have the ability here in this country to think, to rationalize, to investigate, to trial, to study, to explore. And I think that's where I personally think being in the United States, and I say that as someone who grew up in the UK, who's practiced medicine in the UK, who got so disgusted in the 3 months that I worked there in the UK as a physician, I was like, I'm out, I'm back in the US. I cannot work in this environment anymore. Even though it's super laid back and everyone's friendly and kind and wonderful, you don't feel as pressure as here in America. I think that, you know, your question, I think there's more resistance, huge resistance in the UK. And if you talk to UK patients, they're like flailing, they're floating all over. They just like, we don't have any resources. And we have 1,000 patients registered to get tested in the UK. We just opened up SYNLAB in Madrid, which is like the Quest of Europe. And we're going to start, hopefully, it's a whole thing going to EU regulations and whatnot, but we're hoping by the end of this month. We keep on saying, we keep on telling patients, yeah, 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now. And they, you know, they're like, oh, you guys been doing this for a year. I'm like, it just takes a really long time. But we're hoping that we can get the UK patients tested, 1,000 patients there, 1,700 patients in Latin America. Like, unbelievable. Yeah, so they got no resources over there. No resources in Europe. Like, everyone's like waiting for Ramen Bruce to come over and like, good God, seriously? Like, well, unbelievable.
So it's Yo Dr. Yo on Twitter, COVIDLonghaulers.com. And stick around because I'm going to end the recording, but let's talk about this book idea because this is a real story. But Ram, this is brilliant. Just thank you so much. And obviously I'm going to need a follow-up in the next like month or so. So
yeah, no, definitely. Kate, thanks a lot for having me. No, we'll talk offline in a bit about it, but I enjoy trolling you and sending stuff on Twitter. And
that's half the fun. Every time I post something, like your meme game is on point. Like, I mean, for all the work that you've done and everything that we've talked about, I mean, we just lightly skimmed over your abilities on social media when it comes to trolling. You are just, you're a god amongst men, dude.
Thank you. That is the kindest thing anyone could say about my meme and GIF skills. Because, you know, part of it is, we think of these researchers and doctors and things like that as these very learned people with white coats and, you know, these bespoke spectacles and bow ties and, you know, yes, there are those, but that's not me. I'm going to be who I am. And that's going to, I love stupid shit. I love, you know, I don't take myself seriously at all. I take what I do seriously. That whole cliche, it really just something I really abide by. So I don't want people to think of me as like some oh, this researcher that's really this amazing person. No, I'm just a regular dude that just started looking at shit, found some shit. It was shit in garbage trucks. We're trying to get the shit out. We're trying to call it a day. I want to be relatable to people. I don't want to, you know, and I think the same thing with everyone on our team, like Bruce Patterson. I mean, he's the coolest dude ever. You can pick up the phone. You know, he'd be like, hey, what's up? What's going on? Want to shoot the shit? You're like, no, Bruce, I want to talk to like medicine right now. Oh, okay. So, you know, I think when you're relatable, it makes people, they gravitate towards you and they want to know more about you, want to know more about the research, and they open up to you. And when they open up, you learn more about them and you can get them better. It's a trust thing at the end of the day. So that's just really my persona. It's just trying to be relatable. Some people will come out and say, I actually get some messages from people like, oh, you know, you shouldn't be flirting with Kay like that on Twitter. I'm like, if that's what you call flirting, man, I don't know. You haven't seen flirting. So, I mean, if you think like me sending a meme of some guy like winking at you or something, if that's flirting, man.
Yeah.
Some people really need to step up their game.
Yeah, people really do. But, you know, you can thank the Me Too movement for ruining flirting. See, people are going to have a go at me and not realize that was a joke too. But well, it's not even really that much of a joke. No,
don't get canceled, Kay. I'm going to be canceled soon. No, Bruce and I were like, once we put the Vax paper out, I'm almost certain like Twitter's going to, you know, delete me. I'll be off YouTube. I'm going to be, you know, I'm sure like Rolling Stones is going to say like misinformation. You know, they're going to erase me from the internet. But it's fine. We're going to plow through. We're helping people. My life doesn't revolve around social media. It is fun. Don't get me wrong. I like, you know, taking the piss of myself and making fun of others, but there are still ways of getting information out there. So people are not going to stop us. We're going to continue researching and exploring.
I'm glad. No, I think it's so important. And it's so funny. You're not the only person. Like I do, I sometimes help out Joe Pags on his radio show when his newsreader, Carrie Lack, she's absolutely incredible human being. I mean, I've learned so much from her, not only about, you know, how to be my best in terms of communication, but also on how to troll people and be mean to mainly Joe, because it's kind of difficult because he's a really nice guy, but she roasts him like it's going out of fashion and it's so inspiring. But Joe will get messages being like, stop being so mean to Kay. And it's like, no, this is our sense of, this is what makes us relatable. Like, you know, I think it was Raheem Kassam came on the show and said, British people show their love by being horrible. And I think that's, you know, something that we all do best. And you're not even mean. So, Ron, this is not the first, not the last. Please go and listen to the previous episodes we've done together. Check out his YouTube show. I'll put all of the links in the description. But stick around. Let's chat a little bit offline for a second. I got to wrap up the recording. Is there anything I'm forgetting in terms of like directing people to your stuff?
No, thanks a lot for having me. And yeah, we'll keep you posted on things. And, you know, we're going to be putting out a lot of publications, a lot of data in the next couple of weeks. So yeah, we'll see where this goes. Thanks, Kay. Appreciate it.
So I mean, I appreciate you, man. You're literally saving lives. So thank you. You're the rock star here. So that's what Rolling Stone needs to print. Anyway.